Welcome to Minnesota Court of Appeals. We're here on our third oral case, which is 823-1975, in re the custody of OJMP. Counsel, this argument is being recorded on Zoom, but only an audio recording will be posted later on our public website. Each of you has 15 minutes for your principal arguments. Counsel for appellant, you'll have 5 minutes for rebuttal if you choose to use it. If you could keep yourself muted, and we will do the same when we're not talking. State your name and a party you represent for the record when you begin your principal argument. And Mr. Lubina, or sorry, Mr. Tepfer, we are ready for you.
Thank you, Your Honor. My name is Anthony Tepfer, and I do represent the appellants, Charles McCoy and Carmen McCoy. May it please the court and counsel, again, thank you for taking the time to hear arguments on this matter today. The facts of this case and background are, of course, terribly sad and unfortunate. A little girl, Octavia, lost her mother, Nicole, and her father is presently incarcerated, which reality would have been difficult enough. But today we're here because the district court, in deciding permanent placement for this child, made analytical errors so grievous that it cannot be considered anything but abuse of judicial discretion. I believe both briefs adequately address the standard of review. I don't think there's any disagreement or purpose to belabor those points. Appellants are aware that the relief sought requires clearing a very high bar, but in this instance, we believe that bar has been cleared. And I would love to be able to point you to analogous cases or show similar events that were deemed abuses of judicial discretion or not, as the case may be. But the events surrounding this matter are so unique, I truly don't believe there is anything analogous in published decisions of which I'm aware that I was able to find. Briefly, as far as legal background, though, in Pakula, the court stated that a custody decision will not be reversed by an appellate court unless the district court abused its discretion by making findings unsupported by the evidence or by improperly applying the law. And put in another way, in Reed versus State, an abuse of discretion occurs if a district court exercised its discretion in an arbitrary or capricious manner. Appellants today are not arguing.
Can I ask you, is there any case law in Minnesota as to the effect and persuasiveness of creating creating a guardianship and conservatorship position? That's what.
Not that I'm,
go ahead.
Not that I'm aware of, Your Honor.
So, is it a relevant factor at all in the court's determination? It doesn't kind of fit into the statutory scheme. There's no reference to something like that in the statutory scheme of deciding.
Your Honor, the primary issue here is that we have no idea what the relevant factors were in the court's decision because the court, in making their analysis, did no actual analysis beyond one specific factor, in which they stated that being, I believe, the seventh. I would happily walk through and discuss the conclusions that the court did draw and why it shows an arbitrary display of capriciousness. But the fact is, Minnesota statutes specify the court cannot use one factor to the exclusion of all others. And it appears very clear on the face of the document that that's what happened here. The court is required to draw analysis of those best interest factors detailed in 257C.04 and the additional factors in 257C.03. But what analysis there was is non-existent. There was no discussion of how any of the factors in 257C.04 or 257C.03 subdivision 7 impacted their calculations beyond the seventh factor in 257C.04. When regarding the first factor, the court acknowledged that respondents obtained temporary custody both surreptitiously and behind the backs of the rest of the family that were working together to provide the best life they could for this child. They led the family to believe they were invested in fulfilling Nicole's wishes as to the custody of her child while working in secret to undermine those wishes. The court acknowledged that her wishes are important, and the court acknowledged Nicole wanted her brother and his wife, the appellants, to have custody of Octavia. The court's findings of fact clearly stated the decedent wanted this, but the court gave no indication of how this fact affected its ultimate decision-making or why the ultimate decision runs counter to it.
There are, by the way, ask, and it might be a layered question about what you want and what you're asking for. You asked for the court in your conclusion to reverse the district court's order. Are you asking for a reversal and then a directive that the custody be awarded to your clients, or is it a reversal? And, you know, are you seeking remand for explanation? Is it that there can't, you know, it's not adequately explained? What precisely?
No, Your Honor, I'd be
we'd
be seeking a pure reversal and that the award be given to my clients. Our argument is that the facts on the face of this order, the findings as they're written, cannot justify the conclusions drawn. Had analysis been properly made of the factors that were listed and the facts that were detailed in the findings of fact, the argument is that there is not a rational way to come to the conclusion that was drawn.
So just reverse that and it goes back for, reverse the award to grandparents and then they cannot, and then what? You are not seeking, you are seeking, I might have misheard, that they'd be awarded to your clients.
We are seeking that it be awarded to my clients, yes.
Okay, that we would direct that. So not just reverse what happened, but actually, in fact, direct that that is the only reasonable outcome and it must
be.
So it's more than a question of not explaining it adequately. It's a question that on these facts, no court could reasonably exercise its discretion to award to grandparents or to award to anyone other than your client or to grandparents over your clients. Okay. Why isn't it remand for further analysis or explanation a reasonable outcome here? If the problem is they don't really know, I mean, the court talked about it weighs heavily. One could think, well, implicitly it outweighs, you know, because there is a full discussion of each of the factors, maybe, but not an explicit weighting of them.
Certainly, Your Honor, and perhaps it's certainly not the desired remedy for my clients. It would certainly be better than allowing it to stand if for no reason other than at a bare minimum, there needs to be an extremely detailed discussion as to how that factor outweighs everything discussed in the fifth. When the court has acknowledged that we have multiple known sex offenders with victims, the age, gender, and relation of the child, who the parties who were awarded custody have acknowledged they will not limit access to, and one of whom sees her no less than every other week or every weekend and is very close to Octavia. These are all things stated in the court, stated in the original opinion. The court stated that their casual attitude towards this risk is a concern, but at no point opines on how this impacts its ultimate decision. The court made a decision that placed the child with respondents after acknowledging that they will not keep the child away from a convicted sexual predator with victims the same age, gender, and familial tie, and with no explanation as to why the placement was so beneficial to the child as to override such a glaring danger. That factor alone needs substantial exposition, but it's hardly the only issue. The only factor on which the court gave anything resembling analysis was the seventh, the length of time the child, they said, had lived in a stable, satisfactory environment. Didn't balance that against the fact that that came to be because of surreptitious dealings behind the rest of the family's back. Doesn't balance this against the child's age and the fact that we're talking about a 9-month stay in the age of with a 4-year life. Does not balance that against the fact that the parties awarded custody are substantially statistically likely to be deceased before the child is 18 or shortly thereafter, causing them to go through trauma again of losing caregivers.
Counsel, is factor 7 the only factor? Because in looking at the order, particularly findings of fact 70 through 72, under the decision area, it seems like the court does a little analysis, particularly finding of fact 72, they discuss the wishes of the parties and particularly indicates that while it was the wish of the mother to have the aunt and uncle as the custodians, that it was in the best interest that the grandparents have. So my question is, while I quite frankly agree with you that the order is lacking explanation around many of the factors, it seems that implicitly the court does weigh a number of the factors, and looking at this in the light of the favor of the verdict, or looking at it, how does this court get around that? Particularly around there are other findings outside of 7 that the court makes analysis And if the court sees that they're making analysis of more than one factor, is that sufficient?
Your Honor, if you give me just 1 second, I apologize. I wanted to pull up the text in 72, and I have that with me now. Your Honor, admittedly, yes, there is minimal additional analysis related to Nicole's wishes. However, Nicole's wishes are not actually a factor. They're not one of the 12. She's deceased. She is not a party to the case. So while she is touching on Nicole's wishes, it's not further analysis of other factors. It's just continued additional exposition on the seventh factor. Her decision discusses that loss of a parent is tragic, opines that both the grandparents love her, that the aunt and uncle love her. But there is no actual analysis of any of the 16 factors beyond the seventh. There's no explanation as to how this outweighs the substantial negatives brought forth in numerous other paragraphs. She states, of course, that there's kind of a platitude. The court states at the end, there's a bit of a, we certainly hope that, you know, Octavia will have access to everybody and everybody should, takes a village to raise a child type talk. But there's no analysis here beyond she's lived here this long. It's where we think this is best. Okay, bye. There's nothing here to explain or even attempt to rationalize how the court is taking that issue and using it as the overriding factor that outweighs all of the concerns raised about the party who was granted custody throughout the opinion. And they are numerous. To reach the conclusion that the court did, it had to be the only factor discussed, which is why appellants believe it's the only one that there's anything written about.
Can one factor outweigh others to the extent that
the law expressly forbids that.
That one can outweigh the others? What does the law require?
I should rephrase, I apologize. Yeah. It's not that it can't outweigh the others, but if it does, you have to say how and why. Right? The statute expressly states that you cannot rely on one factor to the exclusion of the others. By failing to provide any analysis on the other 15 for which findings were made, it very strongly reads as though that's exactly what was done. There's nothing that changes when we're reading through the primary factors or the additional statutory. A great majority of what the court is discussing regarding the parties who received custody are concerns, reason to be concerned. Appellants will be 76 and 78 years old when Octavia reaches adulthood if they're still living. They're concerned. The court states they have reason to be concerned she's not receiving any counseling that may be helpful to her in the processing the loss of her mother because the respondent said she seemed fine and that she talks a little with the minister. It's 2024. We have access to real mental health care, even by Zoom, and relying on talking with a minister to help a child process the loss of their only available parent is frankly inexcusable. They state that respondents blatantly ignore what we know as society about the truth of grief and mental health to the detriment of a child, which the court acknowledged, but did not analyze or weigh or explain in any way why maintaining the home was more important than the child achieving and receiving this help.
And how old is the child at trial?
At the time of trial, I apologize, I don't recall the exact, but I believe between 4 and 5 years old. I'd have to find the birthday real quick.
And then relative to therapy, was there some, is that just a question that came up at trial, or was there someone with an aunt and uncle seeking that for the child, and the grandparent said, no, that's not right? You know, how does that even
come? Appellants were seeking that at trial, Your Honor, and at the time of, I do have the dates now, at the time of the trial, the child was 4.5 years old. The court further stated that the aunt and uncle were closely involved in helping the mother raise her. They state that the parties are part of a large family, which for reasons discussed earlier in the order, that uncle and aunt don't participate with for the sake of protecting their own daughter from sexual predation. Appellants would maintain that Octavia's relationship with her, the court acknowledged that appellants would maintain her relationship with her stepfather. They acknowledged that appellants would be more likely to facilitate relationship with respondent than in the reverse. They say that the closest person to a sibling to Octavia is appellant's daughter. And although there's no official standby custodian, the court acknowledges that it was Nicole's wishes. These are all things said by the court in its findings. No discussion about how it weighs into their decision. There's no insight, no analysis as to how those other 16 factors weigh in, nor how factor 7 is so important that it overrides all of it. Very little, if anything, is given to the rationale behind the decision, and it's clear the only factor considered was the 7th. At a bare minimum, this has to be reversed for explanation, but reverse and remand on the face makes the most sense.
Thank you, counsel. You'll have 5 minutes for a rebuttal. Counsel for respondent.
Thank you, Your Honor. May please the court and counsel, Blake Lubinus. I represent the respondents, Charles B. McCoy and Donna McCoy, and I will do my very best to maintain proper titles, Your Honor, but we have a lot of McCoys in this case, and we have two Charles McCoys in this case. And so if I slip up and refer to Chuck, that's my client, Your Honors, and just so that the record is clear there. I want to start off by kind of discussing a little bit of the common ground that I have with my colleague, Mr. Tepper. This certainly is a tragic case. This is a grueling trial for everybody. It certainly has had effects on the family that were discussed in the order that we have here, and I would assume that there are certain effects that have had on the family that are outside the scope of today's argument because they're not in the record provided to this court. But at the heart of it, the question that this court has to answer is: are the findings that were made by the district court so clearly erroneous as to justify some kind of reversal remand? I hear Mr. Tepper discuss a possible remand with additional findings, and I question. I'll back up and say, well, I do agree that generally error is preserved on the findings themselves. There is no real argument about the content of the findings in the appellant's brief. There's no real disagreement with the content of the findings. It's just that the findings. Well,
counsel, would it be clearly erroneous when you have two findings that are directly contradictory? And what I'm asking, for example, is in its conclusion of law, the court indicates that it is not in Octavia's best interest for her time with uncle and aunt and Addison to be limited to weekends, family gatherings. And then the court in the same order indicates that uncle and aunt, if awarded custody of Octavia, are more likely to encourage and facilitate relationship with grandparents, while the court in the same order is saying that grandparents are not allowing, and I'm paraphrasing, aunt and uncle to have communication with Octavia. It seems to me like the order is saying that aunt and uncle are going to encourage the relationship. Grandma and grandpa are not. It is in Octavia's best interest to have these relationships, but then the court orders that grandma and grandpa, the individual who they indicate would not encourage the relationship, to have custody. This is one of at least three or four contradictions I see in the order. How does this court look at when we have contradicting findings of fact? We have no findings of fact as it relates to the credibility of the witnesses, and then no analysis as it relates to where the court goes with this. How do we treat that as it relates to whether or not the order is clearly erroneous?
Thank you, Your Honor. With respect to, I'll answer the last part of your question first. With respect to any findings related to credibility, the record is the record. The appellants have the duty to supplement the record so it's satisfactory for analysis, but this court does not make any sort of judgment calls with respect to credibility findings if there are any. I don't believe that there's any requirement. I mean, that that's done, but the
well not this court, the Court of Appeals, but when there are not credibility findings at the district court and there are findings that are directly contradictory, how do this court looks at it from a standpoint of whether or not those findings are clearly erroneous? How do we navigate that when we have such contradictions and no analysis as it relates to who the court believes, why they believe them, and why they did what they did?
In that respect, Your Honor, obviously then a remand with a more detailed findings would be something that could be ordered. I do not know, though, that that is preserved for review of this at this level. There was no motion for amended findings. There was no request for any supplemental analysis from the district court. I believe that issue is waived and by the appellants. They did not seek any amended or expanded findings to ask those kinds of questions. I think that has to be done prior to any appeal on that issue.
But isn't our standard whether there was abuse of discretion?
It is.
Okay.
So that means we
take the findings that exist and we take the conclusions the court drew and conclude from those that the court abused its discretion.
That's correct. That is the abuse of discretion analysis. If the findings are not supported by evidence in the record or they're so clearly erroneous as to lead to an unjust result, that hasn't happened here.
Well, I think, though, I was going to make the same point. Thank you, Justice Klopaki. I don't think the question, and of course, your opposing counsel can clarify this. I do not see a challenge to the findings as clearly erroneous, as lacking an evidentiary record. I see the argument as being accepting those findings that the district court made. It is an abuse of discretion to grant grandparents custody. And clearly erroneous relates to whether the evidence supports the findings. I read their argument as, look at this order, look at the findings. No reasonable person could exercise discretion to grant custody in the way it did. So I think that is the question, is why, looking at those findings, how could the district court act within its discretion in making the award of custody that it did?
And I appreciate that, Your Honor. Obviously, the case law is sparse with related to these kinds of cases because they are so fact intensive. Very few of these get appealed. And so I would agree with my colleague that there's not a lot of specific case law. And this case is so unique by itself, as I would concede that as well, that there isn't going to be another one like this. However, the case law is certainly replete with instances where this court, with the Reviewing Court of Appeals, is allowed to support the implicit findings that are made by the district court. We don't have a full record on appeal. We don't have a transcript of the trial to discuss this in more detail. But that's the appellant's responsibility to do that. But with respect to the reading the order down, as Justice Smith, you indicated, and coming up with whether or not it's an abuse of discretion, I believe the only way to do that is to supplant the court's ultimate decision with one's own. It is perfectly fine for Mr. Tepfer to argue that factors 3, 4, 5, and 6, or whatever, just for instance, support my clients more than they support the others. But the judge didn't find it that way. And the case law doesn't support the Court of Appeals coming in and saying, well, because we would have done it differently, then this case should be reversed or it should even be remanded. That's not the standard of law. The standard of law is that we give deference to the court's findings unless there is something that is so out of bounds that we can't support them. And the court discussed every single factor. The court may, and I would respectfully disagree with my colleague, that the court did not analyze certain things. When we're talking about the therapy piece, it talked that she goes to grandma and she sleeps in grandma's bed and she gets support from her family and she gets support from her grandparents. I don't know where we can say, because it's 2024 and we have therapy, that this judge is so clearly out of bounds that we have to reverse to make that more explicit, when the judge implicitly found that the child is supported by her grandparents. What the appellants are seeking to do, Your Honor, is to turn this into a math problem. We have 16 factors, and if If 9 support one side and 7 support the other side, then the side that gets 9, they win. And that's not how the law works. There is no case law that supports that analysis. There's it just and as we discussed in appellant's principal argument, you can have one outweigh the examples or you can have one factor outweigh the others in importance. There are examples, or one example would be if there's just a dismissal of this because of one singular reason, that would probably be an abuse of discretion to do it that way. However, that's not what happened here. We had a full discussion, you know, several pages of findings that discussed several different aspects of the relationship between Octavia and her grandparents, discussed the interplay between her relationships with her other family members. And at the end of it, the court implicitly and explicitly found that stability for this child in the only other home that she's ever known, aside from her deceased mother, is best suited to be with her grandparents. That's not that's not considering one to the exclusion of all others. That's discussing all of the other factors, finding some that weigh in favor of continued contact with grandma and grandpa, and then making a decision that's best for this child. So I do not believe that this court can review the decision and say this is an abuse of discretion. And it certainly, there is not any justification to say that it's an abuse of discretion to such a degree that it should be reversed and the decision completely flipped the other direction. With that being said, I think that what is clear from this order, what's clear from the record, is that this family loves this child. That they had a very long contested fight to figure out who was going to raise her, and the grandparents came out on top. That's where we are, and that's what the court found, and that's the decision that should be supported. I would yield the rest of my time, but for answering any other questions.
Thank you very much, counsel for appellant.
Thank you, Your Honor. I would disagree with Mr. Labienus's argument that we're seeking a 9v7 type analysis. That's not accurate. My clients are arguing that there has been no analysis. 257C.04b requires that the court make detailed findings on every factor and explain how the factors led to its conclusions and the determinations. The argument here is that that truly hasn't happened. It hasn't. That it's not an explanation for how the factors lead to your conclusions to say, this one's really important, the kid stays here. When you have 70 paragraphs of findings and your analysis touches on one, that is not an explanation of how the factors lead to your conclusions and determination, especially not given the weight and nature of the findings in the other paragraphs.
Well, I was wondering about weight. I don't think weight was discussed in the final. What is weight? Is that a factual finding? Like if the district court had said this weighs, you know, in favor of X, this weighs in favor of Y. What is the weight?
That's an excellent question. I would say that's really it's not a mathematical calculation, obviously. It's an indication at the very least by the judge, by the court as to how much importance they placed upon any given factor, and the only factor for which even that amount of analysis was provided is the 7th. The last paragraph, I believe it's 51. Yes, 51. Octavia's familiarity with and comfort in her grandparents' home weighs heavily in favor of maintaining this living environment. That is the sum total of the analysis of the factors in this case. I understand Mr. Labienus's argument that saying she talks to her grandparents, that's a finding. That's not analysis. There are numerous findings, about 70 paragraphs of them. I may be overstating that slightly. I don't recall exactly which paragraph the findings stop and the discussion begins, but at least 65 paragraphs of findings. One finding gets actual discussion and analysis by the court. One paragraph or one section, well, one factor's worth. I think it's maybe 4 paragraphs. But there's no actual analysis, no discussion about how the rest of this nearly 20-page, I believe, decision impacted the outcome of this case. And at a bare minimum, that needs to have occurred. It doesn't have to be a counting 9v7 or, you know, this many factors versus this many analysis. But if you're going to, this factor outweighs everything else in here, or is the determinative factor, there still has to be discussion as to why that factor outweighs everything else, how everything else has been determined, and how, if at all, it's even being factored in by the court. We can't even tell if, with the exception of the three or four factors that were irrelevant, either due to the child's age or the lack of their applicability to the case.
Well, you're really complaining about the lack of analysis, but yet you want this court to reverse and grant custody to your client. Wouldn't it be appropriate, if you're correct about the lack of analysis, that it be remanded for the court to engage in the analysis that you said wasn't done?
Your Honor, my client's position on this would be that the findings on their face are so clear. It would be I don't want to use the word abuse. It's just what's coming to mind. I apologize. A significant judicial inefficiency. It would be a waste of judicial resources to remand this for further analysis when the facts on their face are clear.
But you've said that you were concerned about why a particular fact is important. That's the analysis, isn't it? And we don't have that analysis from this trial court by your argument. So you're asking us to do the analysis then, aren't you?
To an extent, Your Honor, I'm in a position where I somewhat have to argue both, because our desired outcome is one, but there are multiple potentials for what this court has the authority to do. And while we believe the correct outcome would be a pure reversal, a reverse and remand for other analysis or even remand for retrial is better than leaving this where it is. And I would, unless there are further questions, obviously I'm out of time. So thank you.
Thank you. Thank you both, counsel, for your briefing, for your questions in this important case. We appreciate it. The matter is submitted and we'll have a decision out within the statutory time period.
Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you.